First, if you're looking for something to read or watch in this new year and you're not satisfied with what's out there, well, you might be in luck. As of January 1st, all works first published in the United States in the year 1923 have officially entered the public domain. It's the first time in over 20 years that we've had this kind of mass expiration of copyrights in the U.S. Tens of thousands of films and musical compositions are now officially in the public domain and can be published or adapted without permission from a copyright holder. Our next guest says the release is unprecedented and could have a big impact on culture and creativity. Glenn Fleischman is a freelance reporter who writes about technology, law, and culture. He wrote about this public domain release for Smithsonian Magazine. Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, first of all, tell us what it means from something to move from the, I guess, copyright zone to the public domain zone.
Well, it's kind of a notional place, the public domain. It's not a, it's like a figure ground problem. So copyright is the ground. It's like something is affirmatively under copyright, which gives the owner of that copyright the exclusive right to exploit that material. They can prohibit people from performing a song. They can prevent a publisher from publishing a work, or they can publish or produce something themselves. The public domain is the absence of all those protections, and it only, a work only enters the public domain in very particular circumstances, and one of them is just the time runs out. There's a term, and it varies at points in history as to what that term was in the United States, and we had this long interregnum, a 21-year period, between the last mass expiration of a fixed copyright term and then this year. So in the public domain, works can be exploited in any way people want. There's no owner anymore. The owner is us as the American people, and no one may prohibit your use. You can sell it, you can remix it, you can do an interpretation, you can lambaste it, whatever you want to do, or give it away for free, and that's your right.
Now, if I have this right, under the old rules, right now we'd be talking about the stuff that came out that was created in the year 1962 or something like that?
Well, oh gosh, you know, this is one of these things where I've written about this so much, and it's so complicated, but the very brief explanation is the U.S. used to have a different regime than the rest of the world, and now we're harmonized. So up until 1978, when you copyrighted a work, it was it had a term that lasted from the moment you copyrighted it, from that year, and that term was gradually extended to 95 years by the time 1998 rolled around. If you create a work in 1978 or later, it's like it had been in the rest of the world, which it's the life of the author plus originally 50 years and now plus 70 years in most places.
Okay.
So that's the big distinction.
Now, part of the delay, if I understand this correctly, has to do with Disney not wanting Mickey Mouse to become part of the public domain, right?
That's exactly it. The Steamboat Willie exception, there was a law passed in 1998. It was named for Sonny Bono, who many people know as a performer and Cher's ex-husband, but he was also a congressman, and he died in a skiing accident that year. And his wife assumed his office and then was reelected several times afterwards. And she championed a bill that Hollywood really wanted, which was eventually called the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act. And it added a 20-year period to everything that was about to expire that next year and extended that life of author from 50 to 70 years. So Steamboat Willie was originally supposed to enter the public domain in, I have to remember this, 2004, and now it will enter in 2024 unless anything else happens in the meantime, although that seems unlikely.
Talking to Glenn Fleischman about his piece in Smithsonian Magazine on public domain. A lot of stuff went from copyrightable to now public domain, including this.
We have an old-fashioned tomato, a Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Okay, now ASCAP won't be breathing down our necks, asking us to pay the money for the playing of that song now, I guess. So if I want to create art or a commercial or whatever, I can now mine the output of 1923 and use it as I see fit. Is that right, Glenn?
Yes, although, and I want to point out that on New Year's Eve, I led a chorus of people singing that at midnight in my house. 30 people, because we wanted to celebrate the public domain. That's the nerd I am. There is actually a distinction there. A musical piece that's performed and fixed in a medium like a record or an MP3 or what have you, that still has years to go to expire.
Uh-oh.
I know it's complicated, but
I'm gonna get out some spare change here for that one.
That's right. It's, you probably already paid the license for that. But if it's a piece of a published music, so a sheet music used to be a huge deal, and it still quietly is. But when a song was recorded, what happened is the sheet music could sell in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies. That sheet music, the underlying composition of a piece, everything in 1923 has entered the public domain. My son loves concert band music, and he was excited that there's a piece called English Folk Suite that was written in 1923. It appears to have entered the public domain this year as well, and he could now do a new arrangement of that.
Now, there was this, you wrote about this Robert Frost poem, the famous one, you're out in the snow and you want to go one way or the other, that one. That's now in the public domain, and this was a big issue not that long ago. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah, The Stopping by Woods in a Snowy Evening is probably one of Frost's most popular works, and it's sort of associated with JFK because it was a radio announcer started reading it and then broke down in tears during the funeral cortege of JFK after he was assassinated. And this poem was written in 1923, published in the New Republic, and then in a collection later that year, and it's remained firmly under copyright protection since. The side note is it's possible it wasn't copyrighted correctly, which is a whole other thing, but it doesn't matter now because that 95-year period expired, so we know affirmatively that it's absolutely in the public domain. But the Frost estate and his publisher, Henry Holt and Company, which continues to publish his works, really zealously defended the copyright on that work and others. And there have been attempts by people wanted to produce a famous composer, Eric Whitaker, had produced a composition and released it in 1999, thinking that the work had entered the entered the public domain as it was scheduled to do that year. It had not, and the estate and publisher made him stop performing or releasing this work, which is now called Sleep, but which had been based on that poem.
Now talk about the basic debate here between, okay, you want to protect the rights of a creator to profit from their own works and not be ripped off versus the public interest in, hey, at some point, this is just part of our culture.
That's a big debate, right? And the issue is the Constitution actually defines copyright, which is not entirely unique in the world, but it is unusual. And it says that this exclusive right should happen for limited times. And the question is, what is a limited time? What right was that supposed to grant to an author? What was it supposed to convey? And at the time that the law was first implemented after the Constitution went into effect, the longest period was about 28 years. Over centuries, that lengthened to 95 years. And one asks, who benefits at 95 years? So one sort of rubric for it was maybe it's about two generations following an author's life or a creator's life. So under that thinking, as lives got longer, maybe we did need a longer period. But I haven't been able to find anybody in this last go-round as the expiration neared. None of the companies, organizations, individuals who defended the longer term in 1998, none of them seem to have that defense now. So 95 years for these earlier works and life plus 70 years for later ones, that seems to fit into people's conception of maybe that's just long enough at last.
Now, we've got all these works coming into the public domain from 1923, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, I don't know. But it's not like the government has this register, right, the complete list of 1923 stuff that's now in the public domain. We kind of have to figure it out for ourselves.
That's exactly it. Is copyright is kind of this strange area where even in 1923, you could copyright a work simply by putting the proper notice in, which was literally putting copyright and the C symbol and the year and your name or the proper holder. Because of that, some works were registered because that established ownership and higher damages if you sued and so forth. But this is an ongoing research project because so much was published that we don't know about, and libraries have scanned this material. There's a group called the Hathi Trust that's a consortium of libraries and academic institutions that have been scanning material for years. They were ready. On January 1st, they flipped a switch, and their whole 1923 collection of tens of thousands of works went from scholarly only access behind kind of a restricted wall to keep it safe for copyright protection and went into the public domain and public searching. So other institutions will follow. Google Books has a lot of material. It's unclear what their plans are. The Internet Archive has a lot of material from that period. And then there's also what's neat is there are hundreds of thousands of works people have identified that fell into the public domain over the last many decades because they were not renewed at a time when they had to be renewed. So the public domain is getting ever larger, and researchers are helping us to understand exactly what's in it.
So we've had a long wait for this year's Public Domain Day, but assuming that the laws don't change again, we're going to be celebrating this every New Year's Day from now on?
Yeah, there's another 54 years of this 95-year expiration, and then we switch into the new regime of life plus 70 years. So we got a long time to go. You know, all the Depression-era work, World War II, the 1950s, there's a lot of material that will be slipping slowly in, and academics and researchers are ecstatic about it. I talked to a number of people in academic institutions who, it's not that they couldn't get access to a book before, but it was often difficult to obtain the rights to criticize a poem. Many estates are very, very tight. So as long as a work remains under copyright, they won't even allow an extensive passage from a poem to be published in a book that's critical or even positive of a work. So from that standpoint, there'll be more cultural exploration in that level. But this also is just a simple remixing. Is we live in a remix culture. This material can be digitized and shared, and it's time for, you know, sort of the general public, you know, whether it's individual artists or you know, just people who have an interest in it, they can take this material and use it as what it's intended to be, as a source of inspiration for creating new culture.
Glenn, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's Glenn Fleischman, reporter who writes about technology, law, and culture. He joined us today to talk about his recent piece in the Smithsonian Magazine, looking at the copyrighted material that just became public domain on New Year's Day. And look ahead to next New Year's Day for the 1924 material, I guess.